nearby Jerusalem, then in both Luke's narrative and the Romulan tale, the proclaimers are journeying from a city on a mountain to a city in a valley, roughly the same direction, east to west, like the sun, and roughly the same distance, 7 to 12 miles. Josephus says soldiers were stationed in the region called Emmaus, 30 stadiums from Jerusalem, roughly 3.5 miles. Luke says the town was 60 stadiums distant, roughly 7 miles, although some manuscripts add Hecaton, giving a result of 160 stadiums, roughly 18 miles. It seems more likely, but not certain, that the Hecaton was accidentally dropped than that it was added. In fact, it could have been removed deliberately, since a 60-stadium distance could be crossed twice in a day, as Luke's story requires, while a 160-stadium distance could not. In fact, that would take nearly 3 days in all. So a scribe who realized the story was impossible may have removed the 100 stadiums to restore its plausibility. An original reading of 160 stadiums would be almost exactly the actual distance from Jerusalem to Nicopolis, later identified as Emmaus, and even later known as Emmaus, although some scholars argue this may have been why the Hecaton was added. Whatever its distance, Luke may have intended it to be the same Emmaus mentioned as situated in Judea in 1 Maccabees 3, although Luke might not have written Emmaus at all, as I'll soon discuss. But between Luke's Emmaus narrative and the Romulus narrative, the changes are the point. While Proculus receives his gospel on the road to Rome, Cleopas receives his gospel on the road from Jerusalem. So while the old story suggests all roads lead to Rome, the new story suggests all roads lead from Jerusalem. While Romulus appears in awesome glory, befitting the awesome glory of Rome's dominion and the very visible empire he promises, Jesus appears in disguise, hidden, just as the kingdom he promises is hidden, and which, like Jesus, becomes visible and thus knowable only in the communion of believers. Luke has thus transvalued the Romans' founding myth. Unlike the Romans, their resurrected hero promises a hidden spiritual kingdom originating from Jerusalem on high. And just as the glorious visage of Romulus is what confirmed to Proculus that what he said was true, so it is the powerful word of the gospel that confirms to Cleopas that what Jesus said was true. Luke thus rewrites the story to communicate how Christian values differ from mainstream Roman values. This is a classic hallmark of myth-making, as we saw in the example from Homer and Virgil earlier in this chapter. An intriguing thesis has also been advanced that Luke has further crafted this narrative to reverse the Garden of Eden story. Adam and Eve, whose eating shared food inaugurates death and sin, is corrected by Cleopas and his companion, whose eating shared food signals an end to death and sin, Jesus replacing the serpent and thus setting right what the serpent had set wrong. Evidence that Luke fabricated the Emmaus narrative also lies not only in how thoroughly it is written in Lucan's style, its vocabulary and syntax is entirely his, but also in how well it is crafted to echo Luke's opening chapters in Luke 1 to 2, which means Luke must have created it for that purpose. N.T. Wright identifies parallels throughout, but most strongly in the concluding tale of Luke 2 verses 40 to 50, echoed throughout Luke 24 verses 13 to 33. Where, as N.T. Wright says, we have another Passover, another Jerusalem visit, and another couple beginning their journey away from Jerusalem, either discovering or mistakenly believing that Jesus was not with them. Both couples are distraught at having lost Jesus, and both quickly return to Jerusalem when the pivotal plot point is discovered, when Cleopas and his companion discover Jesus is present, or when Mary and Joseph discover Jesus is absent. Mary and Joseph find Jesus after 3 days, Luke 2, verse 46, and so do Cleopas and his companion, Luke 24, verse 21. In both accounts, Jesus asks what they are doing, quote, why are you looking for me, end quote, or, quote, what are you talking about, end quote, and explains scripture to those present, and says it is necessary for him to have done what he did. In the one case, quote, it's necessary for me to be among the things of my Father, end quote, and in the other, quote, it's necessary for the Messiah to suffer these things, end quote. Both stories also feature the theme of people not understanding what has happened, and both feature a disappearance of Jesus. And both, despite being far too remarkable for any previous gospel to omit, suddenly appear for the first time in Luke. It's obvious he invented them both, deliberately in imitation of each other. Notably in accord with this, at Luke 24, verse 13, the often intriguing Codex Bezdai Has this whole event occur not at Emmaus, spelled Ameos in other treatises of the period, but at Ulameos? This is a name that appears uniquely in the Septuagint narrative of Jacob, in other words Israel, searching for a wife in Genesis 28 verse 19, immediately after which he meets and marries Rachel in Genesis 29, who would give birth to the last two tribes of Israel, Joseph and Benjamin. Ulameos is there identified as the original name of the village of Luz, which Jacob here renames Bethel, God's house, even translated as such, oikos theou, in the Septuagint, which is metaphorically also where Jesus is found after 3 days in the matching couple on a road from Jerusalem story in Luke, that being the most obvious meaning of his cryptic remark at Luke 2 verse 49, and considering where he was, Luke 24 verse 46, God's temple, in other words, God's house. And so most Bibles today indeed translate him as saying he had to be in his father's house. Ulameos is the more difficult reading here, being otherwise so strange, and cannot have been accidental since the name is uniquely found in the Septuagint, and in a story with meaningful parallels, and thus can only have arrived in this Lucan verse deliberately. It is therefore, arguably, the original. The reading of Ulameos in the Septuagint is attested in Justin Martyr and corroborated in Eusebius. Modern editions of the Septuagint read Ulamluz, an evident corruption or variant. Codex Alexandrinus reads Ulameos. It is common in textual criticism to conclude that the Lectio Difficilior, the more difficult reading, is more likely original, since accidents are unlikely to produce it. And there are fewer motives to make such a change deliberately. Scribes not understanding it must have assumed that Ul was a corruption and dropped it to leave Ameos, a far better known town in both Josephus and 1 Maccabees, which then was modified or corrupted into Emmaus. Note that in Codex Besdai, which dates around 400 AD, the parallel Latin text reads Ulameus, so the reading of Ulameus in the Greek was even acknowledged by the translator. The significance of this allusion to Genesis 28:19 with the town Ulameus is that this is the account of Jacob's ladder, Genesis 28 verses 10 to 22, which links all this to the epiphany of the shepherds in Luke, where also a horde of angels descend and ascend, Luke 2 verses 8 to 15. It is also where Jacob blesses the stone he slept on, declaring, quote, "This stone which I have set up for a pillar shall be God's house," end quote, Genesis 28 verse 22, hence the name Bethel. Bethel is also where Jacob is again renamed Israel and promised he'd father an eternal kingdom, thus beginning the first vision of Israel as a nation. It is also where Israel was traveling from when Rachel died in labor-bearing Benjamin, completing the last of the 12 tribes of Israel, just outside Bethlehem, exactly where Jesus would be born, Genesis 35. Jacob had first met Rachel on his way from Bethel, and she later dies on her way from Bethel. And from Jerusalem, Bethel happens to be on the road to Galilee. If Ulameus was the original reading, then the shared direction of travel with the Romulus narrative is north, not west. The road to Rome runs northwest from Alba Longa, so either could have been intended, since Bethel is north of Jerusalem. The distance from Jerusalem to Bethel was believed at the time to be 96 stadiums, 12 Roman miles according to Eusebius, which is roughly in between the variant Lucan readings of 60 and 160 stadiums. Since Luke assumes it is possible to get there in a day and back again by midnight, this would then have to be the very same town where Jesus' parents stopped and returned to find the missing Jesus, in Luke 2, further linking these two stories beyond all the other parallels I've noted already. So Jesus' parents stop at God's house and return to find Jesus in God's house. And both couples find Jesus in God's house, Mary and Joseph in the Jerusalem temple, where the old Israel ends, and Cleopas and his companion in Bethel, where the old Israel began. This does not seem a likely coincidence. Someone understood the connections between Luke 24 and Luke 2 and made them even more elegant and complete by renaming the town. The original author is the most likely candidate for such an achievement. Whether we grant the variant reading of Codex Besdai or not, it's still clear Luke created his Emmaus narrative to echo, and in a sense complete, his previous lost boy narrative. That Luke was fond of this story model is also evident from the fact that he reuses it in Acts to create the meeting between Philip and the Ethiopian eunuch in Acts 8 verses 26 to 40, which also occurs on a road journey from Jerusalem to another town, also features an overt mention of an ignorance of scripture and a question. The question, "Do you understand what you are reading?" matches the question, "What are you discussing?" And it also has a consequent explanation of the gospel from scripture, a request for the interpreter to stay longer, a featured sacrament, in this case baptism, in the Emmaus narrative it's the Lord's Supper, an apostolic opening, Cleopas's eyes are opened to see the truth, and Philip's mouth is opened to reveal the truth, and the sudden disappearance of the interpreter, in this case Philip, who inexplicably vanishes in the midst of the sacrament being performed, just as Jesus does in the Emmaus tale. This is another unbelievable yarn, yet it obviously deliberately adapts the same storyline as the Emmaus tale. Both are fictions. Note also that in the scripture quoted, Isaiah 53 verse 7, the Lord does not open his mouth, but then Philip the apostle opens his mouth. Acts using the exact same words as Isaiah. Similarly, in the Emmaus narrative, Cleopas's eyes are opened, and then he realizes Jesus had opened the scriptures to them, again using the exact same word. I mentioned the additional evidence of the variant reading of Eulamios here because it has another significance, which is to illustrate the general point, applicable to all the Gospels, that we often cannot trust modern reconstructions of the original text of the Gospels, especially Luke and Acts, as noted in chapter 7, and John, as we'll see shortly. They are always, to some extent, hypothetical. The Gospels could easily have said different things in their original composition, and scholars admit as much for many specific verses already. We just saw it's likely Codex Bezdai preserves the original text of Luke here, and that this story was probably said to have taken place not in Emmaus, but in fact Eulamios, in other words, Bethel. This same Codex Bezdai may preserve other original readings, as it contains several variants like this that reflect a clearer consciousness of literary structure in Luke's stories, which is, again, a phenomenon more likely to come from the original author than a later copyist. For example, its text makes Peter's escape from prison in Acts more clearly echo God's departing from the Jerusalem temple. The same is then accomplished by Bezdai's Luke making the stone blocking Jesus' tomb require 20 men to open, just as Josephus had said of the door to the Jerusalem temple, which he says opened of its own accord one midnight to signal God's departure from Jerusalem, an allusion that turns Jesus' departing the tomb into a symbol of God's thereby departing the old Jewish regime. The wording is even similar. Josephus says, "Barely 20 men could loose it." Luke says it was hard for 20 to roll it. This also accords with the evidence that Luke mined Josephus for details to include in his gospel, which I noted in chapter 7, which further argues that this reading was original, as otherwise we must suppose a later scribe knew to continue adding details from Josephus, a less likely hypothesis. Obviously, this won't always be the case. Many variant readings in Codex Bezdai are obviously later revisions or corruptions. For example, it occasionally harmonizes Luke with Matthew by inserting verses from the latter into the former, the most egregious example being half the genealogy. But several of its readings might indeed reflect the original text, for the reasons I've shown. Whatever we make of these facts, I have surveyed several examples even from the most widely accepted text demonstrating that Luke is inventing his story from beginning to end, and not using reliable sources or trying to get at the truth. Even what sources he uses are just previous myths, Mark and Matthew, and at best other fictional gospels now lost, with local color added from historians like Josephus, who didn't write about Jesus or Christians at all. We already verified this conclusion in chapter 9, demonstrating his extensive fabrication of Acts, so we should not be surprised to find his gospel similarly compromised. So once again, there is in fact no way to discern what, if anything, that Luke has added to Mark and Matthew has any historical basis or even a source, and its having a source would still not establish that it's historical. After all, his primary sources, Mark and Matthew, are not demonstrably historical. So why would any of his other unknown sources be? All his added historical color comes from Josephus and probably other now lost historians, from whom Luke derives nothing about Jesus. And many of his additions, like changes to the nativity or embellishments to the resurrection narrative, are historically implausible and rhetorically all too convenient. Some even come from rewriting the Elijah-Elisha narrative of 1 and 2 Kings. As history, all this entails an improbable plethora of coincidences. But as historical fiction, it's exactly what we'd expect. The same conclusion must therefore follow for Luke that we reached for Mark and Matthew. Nothing in it is any less likely on myth than on historicity. It therefore has no evidential value. The burden is therefore on anyone who would insist there is anything in Luke that is any more authentic than what's in Mark or Matthew. As it is, I deem Luke to be just as fictional, showing a wanton readiness to fabricate, and there are no signs of any genuine interest in historical truth or any real ability to discern it, or any indication he has employed any relevant sources more reliable than Matthew or Mark. Luke's value for determining historicity is therefore nil. Even if any historical facts about Jesus are in it, we have no way to identify them. Chapter 10. Continued. Section 7. The Mythology of John. John is a free redaction of the previous Gospels. Some maintain he is independent of them, but there is no evidence of that. To the contrary, the evidence is abundant that John knew all three previous Gospels and used them as sources. He simply redacted them more freely, rewriting everything in his own words, which was the more common way, in fact, ancient writers used sources. In the words of L. Michael White, quote, John's many changes to the synoptics may well have been made intentionally and with full awareness of the synoptic tradition. Several features of the Johannine narrative seem to reflect such an awareness and use of the synoptic tradition, including direct verbal similarities with distinctive linguistic formulations or narrative elements in Mark and Luke, respectively, end quote. In fact, I would say this evidence is adequately conclusive, and that Matthew was also known to John, albeit less used. For example, John copies Mark's pairing of the feeding of 5,000 and Jesus is walking on the water. John 6 thus derives from Mark 6, in the exact same sequence. Yet as we saw earlier, this pairing and sequence was a product of Markan literary structure. It also involves absurd events that obviously never really happened. Accordingly, the only likely reason John would connect these same events in the same order is that he is borrowing the whole sequence from Mark. This is also the only likely explanation for why they share so many precise details in common, such as that 5,000 were fed, that exactly 12 baskets of crumbs remained, that Jesus started with exactly 5 loaves and 2 fishes, and that feeding the crowd would otherwise have cost 200 denarii. John likewise borrows the literary structure of Mark's narrative of Peter's denial of Christ. Just compare John 18 with Mark 14. And the notion that Jesus once cured a blind man with spit, John 9 verse 6, redacts Mark 8 verse 23. But, then, had to back that up with additional magic to get the spell to work, as we see in John 9 verse 7, reimagining Mark 8 verses 24 to 25, and so on. There are many similar matches between John and material in Luke and Matthew as well. Despite frequent protestations and a few dissenting opinions, it is now pretty well agreed among experts on John that he knew and redacted both Mark and Luke, and most likely Matthew as well. For an example of John's use of Matthew, note that John's adaptation of the raising of the centurion's boy in John 4 verses 46 to 53, redacting Matthew 8 verses 5 to 13, which was also redacted in Luke 7 verses 1 to 10, it copies two elements from Matthew's version. The official approaches Jesus directly, rather than through intermediaries, and the word son is used instead of boy. So John definitely used all three synoptic gospels, but Luke especially. Both John and Luke, and they alone, insert the same new character into the story, Martha, the sister of Mary. Both alone have Jesus produce a miraculously vast catch of fish. Both alone claim there was a second Judas among the 12 disciples. Both alone claim Judas Iscariot was possessed by Satan. Both alone report that it was the right ear of the high priest's slave that the disciples chopped off. Both alone have Pilate thrice declare Jesus innocent. Both alone say Jesus was buried, quote, where no man had yet been laid, end quote. Both alone have two angels seen at his tomb. Both alone have the risen Jesus visit the disciples in Jerusalem, not Galilee, and in a room, not outdoors, and show his wounds and share a meal with them. And so on. John changes and expands many of the things he gets from Luke, But the number of coincidences is too great to conclude John isn't simply using Luke as a source, however creatively. Once we can see John is not independent of the other Gospels, but in fact freely using them as sources, we can see that he or they, as this Gospel appears to have had multiple authors and to have been redacted multiple times, aimed to rebut a theme common to them all, that no sign shall be given that Jesus is the Messiah, Mark 8, verses 11 to 12. Mark had clearly written when no miracles had yet been imagined for Jesus, thus he had to explain this. As Paul says, no signs were given to the Jews that Jesus was the Christ, 1 Corinthians 1, verses 22 to 24. Hence, even when Mark invents miracles to put in his story as allegories, he makes sure no one other than the disciples ever either notices or talks about them or understands them. Even the witnesses of the empty tomb never tell anyone about it, Mark 16, verse 8. Matthew had already expanded and corrected this by having Jesus say instead that, quote, an evil and adulterous generation seeks a sign, end quote, and therefore, quote, there shall no sign be given except the sign of Jonah, end quote, Matthew 12, verse 39 and 16, verse 4. Meaning, in other words, the resurrection of Jesus. Matthew thus slightly retreats from Mark by allowing one sign, and accordingly, unlike Mark, Matthew actually narrates a resurrected Jesus and makes sure that in his story the Jews know about it, the whole purpose of Matthew 28, verses 11 to 15. This was not the case before. Matthew is inventing new evidence. The same point was then reinforced by Luke's repetition of Matthew's expanded revision of Mark in Luke 11, verse 29, and by his invention of the parable of Lazarus in Luke 16, verses 19 to 31, and as well the public announcement to the Jews in Acts 2. John refutes this entire sentiment by littering his gospel with explicitly identified signs and by reversing Luke's parable of Lazarus with an actual tale of Lazarus in John 11 and 12, as I'll soon demonstrate. Indeed, John's Jesus fills his ministry with signs that manifested his glory, and it is for this reason, quote, his disciples believed in him, end quote, John 2, verse 11, a notion not found in the previous Gospels. When Jesus is asked for a sign in John 2, verses 17 to 18, he does not declare, as the other Gospels do, that no sign will be given or that only an evil generation would ask for one. Rather, he simply says, albeit cryptically, that his resurrection will be a sign. This is essentially what Matthew and Luke had Jesus say, using a different cryptic metaphor, correcting Mark, who did not even allow the resurrection of Jesus to be a sign. For Mark, it only accomplishes Jesus' defeat of death. But John conspicuously does not say this will be the only sign. To the contrary, he immediately tells us, quote, having seen the signs that he did, many believed in his name, end quote, John 2, verse 23, and, quote, a great multitude followed him because they beheld the signs he did, end quote, John 6, verse 2. And when people, quote, see the sign he did, end quote, then they declare him a true prophet, John 6, verse 14. And we're told, quote, no one can do these signs that you do unless God be with him, end quote, John 3, verse 2. And then Jesus says, you will in no way believe unless you see signs and wonders, end quote. And although this is a rebuke, he nevertheless dutifully performs a miracle to provide them one, John 4, verses 48 to 54. These signs are explicitly said to be the evidence that Jesus is the Christ. Just look at John 7, verse 31, 9, verse 16, and 10, verses 41 to 42. And the Jewish elite lament the fact that, quote, he has done many signs, end quote, John 11, verse 47, and that the people are believing in him because he does these signs, John 12, verse 18. And we're told that those who didn't believe did so specifically in spite of all the signs he did, John 12, verse 37. And though John narrates and sometimes numbers 7 or 8 especially significant signs, all but one, the turning of water into wine at Cana, are inspired by the previous Gospels, he alludes to many others and says there were even more than he recorded, John 20, verse 30, and that the ones he did record, he did so for the express purpose of convincing people to believe in Jesus. Quote, but these signs were written down so that you will believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that in believing you may have life in his name, end quote, John 20, verse 31. And yet, those who believe without seeing signs, like, for example, John's readers, are said to be the more blessed and have an even greater and more admirable faith, John 20, verse 29. This obsessive focus on signs, in other words, proof, is unique to John, and characterizes a lot of what he has done to change up the story, including inventing the most absurd resurrection narrative of all, the Doubting Thomas episode, in John 20, verses 24 to 29. The authors of John are thus very keen to create proof and to insist it is this evidence that justifies belief, a concern not thus voiced in the earlier Gospels. This is why John alone invents an eyewitness source, albeit seemingly unnamed and never heard of before. And he claims he has his information from him, John 19, verse 35 and 21, verse 24. More on this later. And obsessively talks about who and what bears witness of Jesus. And I mean obsessive. John talks about providing evidence, bearing witness, over 31 times, half of those littering three extended discourses on the subject. There is nothing like this in any of the previous Gospels. The authors of John were clearly maniacal on the subject and eager to beat that dead horse to a pulp, thereby improving on the previous Gospels, who didn't do this, but even badmouthed the whole idea. This also makes John the most ruthlessly propagandistic and thus the most thoroughly untrustworthy of all the canonical Gospels. This is already evident from the rest of the Gospel's content. John's Gospel contains long, implausible, never-before-imagined speeches of Jesus, and yet no Sermon on the Mount, or indeed hardly any moral instruction of any sort. And entirely new characters and events, also never heard of before, like Nicodemus, Lazarus, Cana. John also changes everything around, such as moving Jesus' clearing of the temple to the beginning rather than the end of his ministry, expanding his ministry from 1 to 3 years, with multiple trips to Judea and Jerusalem rather than only one, and moving the date, and thus even the year, of Jesus' execution to make Jesus' death correspond exactly with the slaughter of the Passover lambs, as I noted earlier. John has thus run wild with authorial gluttony, freely changing everything and inventing whatever he wants. By modern standards, John is lying. A major problem with evaluating what John has done is that we don't have what he originally wrote. We know someone later reorganized the gospel, putting scenes out of order and adding or subtracting in the process, though we can rarely know what. That the gospel has been meddled with is already evident from the fact that it has two endings, each of which seemingly ignorant of the other, John 20 verses 30 to 31 and John 21 verses 24 to 25, each concluding different appearance narratives, John 21 verse 1 being a hastily added line attempting to stitch them together. A phenomenon that also plagued the Gospel of Mark, which had at least 5 different endings. Besides the 3 endings for Mark, sometimes noted in modern Bibles, a conclusion at 16:8, a shorter ending that adds one more verse, and a longer ending that adds 20, there are at least 2 other known endings, one incorporating an ascension narrative into the empty tomb narrative, and one adding a whole new speech from Jesus in the so-called longer ending. See my book Hitler, Homer, Bible, Christ for more on all that. As for John, there is John 20 and John 21, and there are arguments for and against either as interpolation and the other as original, complicated by the fact that the redactor who added either may also have added other material throughout the gospel. For example, if John 20 verses 19 to 31 is an interpolation, so might John 11 verse 16 be. Both endings are redacted from Luke. John 21 redacts Luke 5, which is not there a resurrection appearance, and Luke 24 as well, while John 20 redacts Luke 24. And of course, everyone knows that the story of the adulteress, John 7 verse 53 to John 8 verse 11, which gave us the famous line, "Let he who is without sin cast the first stone," was added by a later editor. But there is even more evidence the whole document has been corrupted, with material inserted and possibly deleted, and sections moved around, often sloppily. For example, in John 5, Jesus goes to Judea, Jerusalem, in fact. Yet in John 6, he is not in Judea. Instead, in John 5, Jesus is in Jerusalem, and then immediately, in John 6, he went off to the other side of the Sea of Galilee. But the Sea of Galilee is nowhere near Jerusalem, nor even in Judea. Clearly, in the original text preceding that verse, Jesus had been in Galilee somewhere on the opposite shore of its sea and not in Jerusalem. The order of events has thus become jumbled. Similarly, we're told Jesus is in Jerusalem in John 2, and then that he entered Judea in John 3, But if he was in Jerusalem, he was already in Judea. Evidently, some mention of his return to Galilee has been moved, or more likely deleted. Likewise, at one point, Jesus concludes a speech by saying to his disciples, "Arise, let us go from here," John 14, verse 31. But instead of doing that, for no intelligible reason, he gives another long rambling speech spanning three whole chapters, John 15 through 17, and only after that do they depart, in John 18, verse 1. The last line of chapter 14 and the first line of chapter 18 clearly followed each other in the original text, which means someone inserted this vast speech in between. An even more glaring example is when we're helpfully told that a certain Mary, quote, was that Mary who anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was sick, end quote, John 11, verse 2. Yet that event hadn't even happened yet, John 12, verses 2 to 3. Evidently, originally, the resurrection of Lazarus followed the anointing by Mary, but someone reordered the sections and added a new back reference in John 12, verse 1, but forgot to delete the original back reference, or at least to rewrite it so that it looked forward to a future event rather than a past one. Because of all this and other evidence besides, experts on John's gospel generally agree it had multiple authors and went through multiple redactions before coming to its present form. The so-called Egerton Gospel, one of the earliest papyrus fragments of any Christian gospel we have, may be a piece of an earlier version of John, into which our John has inserted material and moved content around, since it definitely has lines found in John, but in a different order and mixed with different material. Nevertheless, some evidence of John's original literary artifice has survived this hacking up and reordering and altering of his text. One of the best examples is the brilliantly framed sequence where Jesus travels from Cana to Cana, an adventure and city nowhere else mentioned in the other Gospels, although it incorporates one story from them, which John has completely rewritten. Why have these events take place at Cana? We can only speculate. No previous Gospel mentions anything ever happening there, whereas John deliberately frames a whole literary sequence with two incredible events there. So the selection of Cana is clearly an invention of John. There was a Cana, Josephus camped there, but its selection by John was probably mythosymbolic. The tale of the Syrophoenician woman in Mark had become the tale of the Canaanite woman, Cananiah, nearly the same word that would be used of someone from Cana, in Matthew. This was a tale of the faith of a foreign woman earning God's grace, and in which a demon is cast out of the woman's daughter as she requested, which has certain parallels with the Cana to Cana sequence in John, which is also about faith earning a reward, and adapts the foreign woman theme into the encounter with the Samaritan woman. Note that John deletes all exorcism scenes from Jesus' story. John may have chosen to frame the Samaritan encounter with events at Cana to create a parallel between the beginning, end, and middle, the latter to remind us of the woman from Cana in Matthew and its parallel passage. Another possibility are certain parallels with Joseph's feats of dream interpretation in Genesis 40, where Joseph interprets the dreams of a master of wine and a master bread maker, just as John's story features a master of the feast, which combines both roles. Both stories involve an actual feast where something eventful happens on the third day. In the Old Testament tale, Joseph explains to the bread master that the three baskets of bread in his dream represent 3 days, after which he would be crucified, while the other of the two men, the wine master who dreams of creating wine from three vines, will be saved. The word used here for baskets in the Septuagint is Cana, the plural of Canaan, the exact same spelling of the town of Cana. Whether that's where John got the idea or not, this role of Cana is John's invention, a literary construct meant to illustrate different degrees of faith and what one must do to achieve them. The gospel begins with a multi-day sequence that has become garbled. John is preaching about the coming Jesus in John 1, verses 15 to 28, and then, quote-unquote, the next day, John 1, verse 29, Jesus just suddenly appears. John identifies him, and Jesus begins recruiting disciples and preaching about who he is, and then, quote-unquote, the next day, John 1, verse 35, we hear more of the same, and then, quote-unquote, the next day, John 1, verse 43, Jesus decides to go to Galilee, evidently, unlike the other Gospels, In John, Jesus recruits his principal disciples near the Jordan River in Judea or Perea, not in Galilee or by its sea. So in any case, 4 days have passed, and the next day should be the 5th day. Yet now we are told that, quote, on the 3rd day there was a marriage in Cana of Galilee, end quote, that Jesus attended. We're not told why or who was getting married. I suspect those elements may have been deleted. So something might be out of order, but visible structure does begin at this point. The sequence now starts with this miracle at Cana, quote-unquote, on the 3rd day, and then ends with another miracle at Cana on another 3rd day. That Jesus' second visit to Cana occurs on the 3rd day is discernible from the text. He spends 2 days with the Samaritans, John 4, verse 40, the number of days Jesus would later reside in the land of the dead. He even dies at the very hour that he meets the first Samaritan, at the quote-unquote 6th hour, John 4, verse 6, deliberately echoing John 19, verse 14, thus making his descent into Samaria and return a metaphor for his death and resurrection. And then, quote-unquote, after the 2 days, John 4, verse 43, he went to Galilee, and to Cana in particular, which means it is once again the 3rd day when he arrives at Cana. And so we're told, quote, he came therefore again unto Cana of Galilee, where he made the water wine, end quote, John 4, verse 46, and performs there, quote, the 2nd sign that Jesus did, end quote, John 4, verse 54, the previous miracle at Cana having been the 1st sign, John 2, verse 11, thus even reminding us how and where this sequence of events began. The allusion to Jesus' resurrection on the 3rd day is obvious. It thus frames the whole sequence and is metaphorically represented in his journey through Samaria, on his way from Jerusalem to Cana. But it is most obvious in John 2, verse 19, where Jesus' resurrection in 3 days is made explicit, albeit through a metaphor, which of course is not understood by the Jews. John's readers are thus being warned not to make that same mistake and miss John's metaphors. That the sequence begins with turning water into wine, a miracle unique to John's gospel, which is echoed in the fact that water and blood run from Jesus' wound at his crucifixion, another miracle unique to John's gospel. And then ends with a resurrection of a son. In John 4, verses 47 to 53, the boy there is, quote-unquote, about to die, and yet, quote-unquote, lives at the word of Jesus. That only reinforces the metaphor. The centerpiece of what goes on in between is the speech of John the Baptist explaining it. Jesus is both the bridegroom, thus echoing the wedding at Cana, and the Savior, thus echoing the subsequent act of saving a child, the official's son. John also says people should believe on Jesus' word alone. The overall structure of what happens in between this sandwich of appearances at Cana is in fact superbly elegant. It starts with the traditional context, which features a woman as a mother, then moves to another traditional context, which ends with a man, then moves to a marginal context, which begins with a woman, then moves to another marginal context, which features a man as a father. Each section is in turn structured. The outside sections, the beginning and end, the first traditional context, and the last marginal context, parallel each other. And so do the inside sections, the second traditional context and the first marginal context. The first outside section is John 2, verses 1 to 12, which is about a wedding completed at Cana, featuring a mother and her son, in which a miracle is requested and fulfilled, and we learn what complete faith looks like in a traditional Jewish context. The story then ends at Capernaum. The last outside section is John 4, verses 43 to 54, which is about a funeral averted at Cana, featuring a father and his son, in which a miracle is requested and fulfilled, and we learn what complete faith in a marginal Jewish context looks like. And this event begins at Capernaum. These two parallel stories then wrap around the two inner sections, the second traditional context and the first marginal context, each of which is divided into 3 stories, each sequence showing the same progression. In the first of these, the traditional context that ends with a man, we have the first story about Jesus clearing the temple, in which a miracle is requested and not fulfilled. Then Jesus' words are thrown back at him, a question is thus voiced as disbelief, and a metaphor of resurrection is misunderstood, all of which showing the temple Jews having no faith. Then in the second story, about Nicodemus and the Pharisees, Jesus is believed because of his miracles. Then Jesus' words are thrown back at him, a question is thus voiced as doubt, and a metaphor of rebirth is misunderstood, all of which showing a teacher of the Jews having partial faith. Then in the third story, about John the Baptist, Jesus is believed because of his word, and Jesus' words are explained, he is the Savior, showing John having complete faith. This same sequence is repeated in the next section, the first marginal context that begins with a woman. There, we have the first story, about the Samaritan woman at Jacob's well, where again a miracle is requested and not fulfilled, and again Jesus' words are thrown back at him. A question is thus again voiced as disbelief, and again a metaphor of living water is misunderstood, all of which showing the woman having no faith. Then in the second story, about the same Samaritan woman reconsidering this, Jesus is believed because of his miracle. Then Jesus' words are thrown back at him, a question is then voiced as doubt, and a metaphor of a spiritual Messiah is misunderstood, all of which showing the woman having partial faith. Then in the third story, about the Samaritans of Sychar, Jesus is believed because of his word, and Jesus' words are now understood, Jesus is the Savior, showing the Samaritans having complete faith. The parallels here are far too numerous and neat to be accidental. They are clearly composed in awareness of each other, even beyond the deliberate connections I just outlined. For example, what is said in the third story of the second marginal context presupposes knowledge of what is said in the preceding parallel, the third story of the second traditional context. Since nothing is said about what Jesus tells the Samaritans that convinces them, we're simply to understand it is essentially what the Baptist says in their structural parallel. John has invented all of this material to make a point, and has designed it all to fit his desired pattern of parables and metaphors. Two miracles that parallel and invert each other happening at Cana, and in between two sequences of three conversational narratives, the first of those triads paralleling the second in its development of examples from having no faith to having partial faith to having complete faith. We also see the one triad in a traditionally Jewish context, and then the second triad repeating all the same themes in a more marginal context, and alternating the roles of men and women, as we saw Mark once did. The two framing events also share structure. Each involves an announced problem, running out of wine, or an official's son is ill. They involve a request, Jesus is asked to fix the problem. They involve a sharp rebuke, Jesus says something snarky to the one making the request. They involve a reaction, the requester puts complete faith in Jesus. And they involve its consequence, the deed is done, what they believed he could do, he does. The first occurs in a traditionally Jewish context, a Jewish wedding. The second in a marginal one. The official, a basilikos, was neither surely Jewish nor surely Gentile. Being from the court of the Herods, he would have had a dubious status among conservative Jews, as possibly not really Jewish even if he really was. In between, we see a similar contrast. Jesus first interacts with traditional Jews and then Samaritans, who actually were Jews, being a divergent sect of Judaism, but not considered as such by traditional Jews, a marginal status similar to Mormons among Catholics and Protestants today. Thus, John repeats the same literary elements in both traditional and marginal contexts. First, a traditional context, a wedding, followed by another traditional context, Temple Jews and John the Baptist, followed by a marginal context, Samaria, that is followed by another marginal context, helping a Herodian official. Thus, we see elegant literary invention in John just as we saw in the earlier Gospels. Almost certainly the whole Gospel once had a complete and elegant structure throughout, just as we saw Mark and Matthew did. It has simply been lost by later editors reorganizing the text. For an extensive analysis of the structure of this Cana sequence, which I have adapted and expanded from Francis Maloney's From Cana to Cana in Volume 40 of Salesianum, October-December 1978. Maloney believes that the inserted remarks at John 2 verses 23 to 25 and John 4 verses 30 to 38 where a metaphor of spiritual food is misunderstood by the disciples, are also part of the structure. But they are too dissimilar and not logically integrated with the surrounding material. John 2 verses 23 to 25 are about Jesus knowing the minds of men and judging them, a subject that is not any part of the narrative at this point, which is entirely about believing or not believing in Jesus. The transition from verse 22 to 23 is thus nonsensical. The transition from John 4, verse 38, to verse 39 is likewise illogically abrupt, and the question posed at verse 33 makes no sense in light of the fact that they are supposed to have seen Jesus having just met someone. A clumsy solution to this problem is verse 27, which is a strange addition that otherwise serves no narrative purpose other than to try and fix the problem created by inserting the following conversation. Accordingly, I think it's clear that both John 2, verses 23 to 25, and John 4, verses 30 to 38, are out of place and thus later insertions. Nevertheless, if you disagree, then Maloney shows how they still fit into the structure. Maloney also believes what we have in this narrative are parallels between Jewish contexts and non-Jewish contexts. But since Samaritans were marginal Jews, and since John deliberately changed the centurion to a basilicus, the long-distance healing of an official's son in Capernaum is obviously a redaction of the long-distance healing of the centurion's son at Capernaum in Matthew 8 and Luke 7, he clearly avoided a Gentile context and created another marginal context instead. Thus, John is paralleling traditional and marginal contexts, not Jewish and Gentile, though the implication may be that Gentiles are likewise a marginal group who can likewise come to faith and salvation. As also for the other Gospels, John likewise employs the device of inventing his stories by creatively and meaningfully rewriting stories or adapting story ideas from the Old Testament. The first miracle at Cana, John's only new miracle for Jesus, every other has precedence in the other Gospels, is a perfect example of this. It reifies the word of God in the book of Exodus, where Aaron, quote, did the signs in the sight of the people, and the people believed, end quote. Exodus 4, verses 30 to 31. The basic model for John's entire gospel. And here in particular, God had told Moses he will give him three signs to perform, such that if they don't believe after the first two signs, they will believe after the last. Exodus 4, verses 1 to 9. That last miracle God explains to him thus, quote, if they will not believe even after these two signs, nor listen to you, then you shall take some of the water from the river and pour it on the dry ground, and the water that you took out of the river shall become blood upon the ground. End quote. Exodus 4, verse 9. So the last miracle Moses was to perform was to turn water into blood, in other words, water into wine. John has Jesus perform this as his first miracle, thus starting where Moses left off, and turning the last into the first. At the crucifixion, of course, Jesus spews water and blood from his body, John 19, verse 34, thus ending his ministry with a reminder of the miracle he started it with, a fact Jesus even alludes to in John 2, verse 4, which contains two references to John's crucifixion scene. Jesus references the hour of his death, which, like the bridegroom theme, is also evoked again in this sequence at John 4, verse 6, and the fact that he would no longer be his mother's son, John 19, verses 26 to 27. Another addition unique to John, just as is a wound spewing water and blood, proving that John had this in mind and rewrote the crucifixion scene to match his scene at Cana. Indeed, the one scene is an antitype of the other. At Cana, his mother gives a command to Jesus, but at the cross, Jesus gives a command to his mother. At Cana, his mother says to do whatever he says, and at the cross, Jesus says what to do. At Cana, his mother asks Jesus to give them wine from water, and at the cross, he gives them blood with water. At Cana, Jesus asks what he has to do with her, and at the cross, he says he has nothing to do with her, transferring her kinship. At Cana, he says his hour is not yet come, and at the cross, it has come. He even repeats the very same Exodus theme. The miracle of the water and blood at the cross occurred, quote, so that you may believe, end quote, John 19, verse 35, exactly as God told Moses would happen. In just the same fashion, from the water miracle at Cana, quote, the disciples believed in him, end quote, John 2, verse 11. Therefore, so should you. John is thus simply duplicating the last miracle of Moses. He needed to develop other themes, such as a wedding, to evoke the metaphor of Christ as the bridegroom that he would introduce in this overall sequence, John 3, verse 29, a mother and son scene to reverse the father and son scene he was to conclude with, some way to introduce his desired number symbolism, the number and volume of the pots had some significance now lost to us, in John 2, verse 6, and to make the features of this tale line up with the one he would close with, and to create the message about faith that the whole sequence was designed for, and so on. The result was this fanciful tale. But he also got several of the ideas for it from a similar tale of miraculous provisions told of Elijah in 1 Kings 17, verses 8 to 24. There we are also told of a woman and her son, though who in this case are starving to death and expect soon to die, 1 Kings 17, verse 12. And indeed her son approaches death from illness, and Elijah must heal him, 1 Kings 17, verse 24, just as Jesus would then save a man's son from a deadly illness for his second miracle at Cana. As Randall Helms explains, quote, one of the most puzzling aspects of this first miracle in the fourth gospel is Jesus' rudeness to his mother. Quote, woman, what have I to do with you? End quote. This statement is here not a historical report, but an antitype of Elijah. For the woman, in need of food, says to the prophet, quote, what have I to do with you? End quote. 1 Kings 17, verse 18 in the Septuagint. In both stories, the prophet instructs those in need of sustenance to take empty pitchers, hudria in the Septuagint text of the Elijah story, and hudriai in John 2, and remove from them the needed provision, which miraculously appears, end quote. Note also that when Aaron performs the water-to-blood miracle for the Egyptians, water in stone pots is also transformed. The pots in John's miracle are also made of stone. We know later Jewish lore also held that when Moses struck the rock in the wilderness, which rock the Christians equated with Jesus, blood came out at the first blow and water at the second. But I could not confirm that this belief existed in early Christian times, though that does not mean it didn't. An extensive case has also been made that John's wedding at Cana is modeled after a wedding in Esther by Roger Ouse. The parallels there are intriguing but inconclusive, in my opinion. It thus remains a possibility, perhaps true but unprovable. Ouse also discusses the pagan parallels of Dionysian pots miraculously producing wine, a frequently performed miracle in ancient temples. In any case, we know John is getting his account of a miraculous provision of food from the Old Testament account of Elijah, where Elijah does much the same thing. From this and the healing of her son, the very same two miracles John frames his whole Cana to Cana sequence with, the woman concludes Elijah truly is a man of God. That both stories copy the exact same unusual phrase, what have I to do with you, te amoi kaisoi, have the same equipment, hudria or hudriai, and involve essentially the same feat, miraculously appearing sustenance, is a sufficient clue to what John has done. This is a literary construct. It is not history. And it is clear John is well aware of that fact, since he carefully links this miracle with his revised account of the crucifixion, and carefully integrates it into his overall Cana to Cana structure. Thus we can know John does not really care about history. He is weaving tales and passing them off as history. A key demonstration of this is John's invention of an eyewitness, the seemingly unnamed beloved disciple, as noted in John 21 verse 24 and John 19 verse 35 and other passages. That he is an invention should already be evident from the fact that he is inserted into the story told by the previous Gospels, which never heard of him. No male disciples are at the cross in any other Gospel, much less told by Jesus as he hangs on the very cross to take Jesus' mother in. Nor does anyone else run to inspect the tomb other than Simon Peter in Luke, and even that is a fabrication, since in Mark and Matthew, no disciples are even in Jerusalem at the time. Nor is anyone resting, a most remarkable thing, on Jesus' breast at the Last Supper. John has clearly inserted this figure into these stories he inherited from the Synoptics, and then claimed this new character as his source, who saw all these things. In plain terms, that's simply a lie. Peter running with the beloved to see the burial cloths in the now empty tomb is most likely adapted from Luke, and this inspired John's use of burial cloth symbolism here and in his account of the raising of Lazarus. Almost all manuscripts of Luke have Peter running to see the empty tomb and finding the burial cloths within. And I believe this was indeed in Luke's original, as Luke is the first gospel to imagine the disciples are present in Jerusalem for the women to report to. In Mark and Matthew, the disciples are in Galilee and never receive the women's report. And Luke omits mention of a second disciple, and many other details in John, like the presence of the sudarion, or face napkin. And thus is not likely a harmonization with John. The more so, as reference to Luke 24 verse 12 is found in Luke 24 verse 24, and a double redaction is less likely. In fact, John repeats several elements from Luke, that there were two angels instead of one, which only women saw, that Mary reported the empty tomb to the disciples and wasn't believed, that Jesus appeared in disguise and was only recognized in a special moment, that the first to recognize the risen Jesus went to report it to the disciples, who were gathered together in a room in Jerusalem, and, if we accept Luke 24 verse 12, Peter's running to the tomb and finding burial cloths within. But then he adds this new figure to the story, the Beloved, where no such person existed before. All of this shows John is making it up. Confirmation of this fact lies in a detail often overlooked, that in fact the beloved disciple is not unnamed. As Floyd Filson had already famously argued over half a century ago, and has have many others since, it should be obvious that the author of John had taken sufficient pains to make clear that the beloved disciple was Lazarus. This has been well argued separately by Floyd Filson and Keith Pearson. James Charlesworth argues against them, but his arguments are far more feeble, gullible, and fallacious, as you can judge for yourself. His seventh argument, for example, is an absolute howler, and representative of the kind of mindset we're dealing with here. Lazarus, he says, can't be the beloved disciple, because Lazarus could not possibly run faster than Peter, since he had recently been resurrected from the dead, and we all know people recently miraculously resurrected from the dead are too feeble to outrun anyone. Oh no, not even in fiction. Charlesworth's case for Thomas being meant, the thesis of his whole book, is similarly far weaker than any case that can be made for Lazarus. Only one character in John's gospel is described repeatedly as, quote, the one whom Jesus loved, end quote. And that's Lazarus, John 11 verse 3, 5, and 36. And right after Lazarus is introduced and described as Jesus' beloved, he is reclining with Jesus at supper the next day, John 12 verses 1 to 2 and 9 to 11. So when we hear that, quote, the one whom Jesus loved, end quote, is reclining with Jesus at the Last Supper as well, John 13 verses 23 to 25, the allusion should be obvious. Likewise, every other appearance of the one whom Jesus loved, at the crucifixion, at the empty tomb, and at the resurrection. Lazarus may have been explicitly declared a disciple in a passage since deleted from the original John, but even if not, the beloved is clearly Lazarus, now discipled. This conclusion is only confirmed by the fact that in John 21 verses 21 to 24, we're told the notion had spread that the beloved disciple would never die. And there is no reason why such speculation would surround that one disciple unless he was Lazarus, who alone in John's gospel had undergone resurrection, provoking the question whether he could die a second time. Since John has clearly invented the Lazarus and beloved storylines, this question about whether he could die again is either an invention of the author to make a point about people raised by Jesus in general, such as in the earlier gospels, or a later redaction answering a question that had arisen in response to an earlier edition of John, or an anticipation of such. We are also told the beloved disciple was the first to see the burial cloths Jesus had cast off in his now empty tomb, and Lazarus had been wrapped in burial cloths, also cast off at his resurrection. And so it is he who is the first to believe Jesus had risen. Lazarus also rose from a tomb, the only resurrection account in the Gospels in which that was the case, other than the resurrection of Jesus. And although whereas Lazarus was expected to stink of death, Jesus was extensively perfumed. In both accounts, the peculiar detail of the deathly veil is mentioned, the sudarion, a napkin covering the face of the dead. And in both accounts, this is distinguished from the burial wrappings, and in both accounts we find references to being bound or unbound by these, as a metaphor for being bound by or freed from death. And in both accounts, we're given a vivid picture of these burial wrappings and their disposition. For Jesus, we're told the linen cloths, othonia, were in the tomb, and the napkin, sudarion, that was upon his head, which was not lying with the linen cloths, but rolled up in one place. John 20, verses 6-7. For Lazarus, we're told, he walked out of the tomb